Episode 11 of Season 17. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is Geekspeak. Sitting in the studio with me today is Miles Elam. He's a pedant and programmer, and you know him quite well. Hi, Miles.
How's it going?
We also have on the line from Emeryville, California, Dee Dee Hubbard, who is a soon-to-be unemployed engineer. Hi, Dee Dee.
I didn't do it. Nobody saw me do it. You can't prove anything.
Let's talk about the FCC. What are they doing? They're doing bad stuff.
Not so much doing bad stuff as no longer doing good stuff.
How so?
The FCC was taking a role in the past in trying to address the digital divide. Those who have access to the internet and those that don't, especially those who have less financial means. Because if you, for example, have a household, especially with kids, where you don't have ready access to the internet, you have kids that are growing up without that access, without the ability for research. It's happening more often with regard to schools. You have the inability to be able to just get familiar with it, to learn how to interact with the computer in the modern age, essentially. And so there were programs in place, one particular called Lifeline, so that you would give subsidies, in other words, $9.25 a month toward communication service.
So they could like help subsidize internet access.
Right. And it's also deals that have been going on with broadband providers has gone along with it to say, if you have these low-income communities, you need to offer a broadband package that is affordable. Even if
right.
it's a slower speed than most other folks get it, you have to still provide that lower tier.
And, of course, traditionally, telco is not going to want to do infrastructure development in that area because they're not going to necessarily have a lot of customers. And so the subsidy also helped have enough revenue in that area to make it attractive for the telco to go in. So there was the balance between the people's needs, the government, and telcos.
Right. And Lifeline, in particular, is a 32-year-old program.
Oh, it's been around a while.
Yes.
Did this handle phones as well?
It was originally for phones and then was adapted for internet access. Well, there's a new sheriff in town, a new administration, and along with it, a new FCC chief. And that FCC chief has announced that they are no longer going to honor any expansions of that Lifeline program. So even if providers want to do it, they're not going to honor any of those requests anymore, any of those, here's the number of people, we want to get reimbursed, sorry, no.
Oh, man. It seems a little ridiculous because, of course, the whole idea there is that if people have access to communication, especially internet, they theoretically are going to be able to be more successful financially in life in general and therefore possibly help themselves get out of a situation that's not so pleasant financially.
Well, here you have the difference in philosophies among people in government and in our society with regard to whether or not income inequality is an actual problem and whether or not you want to provide help to people who are not doing as well, or if you believe that everyone can just pull themselves up by their bootstraps and it really is a fair playing field as long as you work hard.
Also, there's just it just speaks to the digital divide and the differing opinions on whether or not the fact that we conduct more of our affairs and public things on online and access to the internet and broadband in general is becoming more and more of a requirement to be a productive and like informed citizen.
Or to submit resumes, to get in contact with folks, to be able to work from home and have that option, to be able to do modern banking.
Yeah. It's kind of necessary at this point.
Yeah.
Well, boo on the FCC for doing that. That's horrible.
Although not unexpected.
No, I guess not.
I mean, it's funny. The same people who think that their 10-year-old can't go without a cell phone are taking away this lifeline, literally. This is the name, the lifeline for poor Americans who can't afford this on their own.
Okay, well, that's nice and depressing. I'm so sorry about that, and thank you for the story, Miles. And Miles, would you cheer us up a little bit by something space-age and cool?
SpaceX has always tried to make space travel cheaper, more affordable, less wasteful. One of the goals there was to be able to reuse rockets. In the past, they've done this for having rockets land on a barge, you know.
So or not land on a barge first and then successfully land on a barge. Yeah, the videos of those landing on the barge are pretty cool. And that we're talking about the large fuel tank, which of course gets jettisoned before you
the
get in orbit
stage, yeah.
and it falls down to Earth. So they've been actually letting it fall and then piloting down and landing on the barge.
Right. And all the ones that have landed successfully, they have taken apart and analyzed, or they've put into a display case. The very first one is put in for posterity purposes.
With the whole idea of they're doing research to potentially reuse these things.
Right, and see how they did stand up.
How have they been standing out? Have they had some success?
Well, what they were doing now was launch one of their reused rocket, one of the first stages that have come back, to use that again, refuel it, get it prepped, and launch back into orbit, or use it to launch its payload up into orbit. They did it. They launched it up again. And
that's really cool. Reusable spacecraft.
Right.
And, of course, the Russians have been doing it the entire time.
And brought it back down again.
Yeah. That is really
successfully.
Cool. I mean, because does that mean that the large tank stage on the U.S. space shuttle, was that always disposed of and destroyed?
The solid rocket boosters on the sides, those were always disposable. They were only one-time use. The main tank would be reused, except that it didn't end up being how it was being how it was originally touted.
Mm-hmm.
When it fell, they would recover it. And then they take it apart and
put it back and rebuild it.
Yeah, clean off all the parts and repair any weak spots, and then put it all back together. And you really didn't have any savings
because it was just rebuilding it again.
Right.
So in this situation, they landed it and then checked it out probably for leaks, and then filled it up and did it again.
Right.
Yeah, that's really cool. All right. Well, speaking of space missions, Dee Dee found this wonderful post and mentioned it to me earlier today. Ariel Waldeman is very into space. Her kind of subtitle is What I Like in Space. It's kind of her Twitter feed. And she's just made some videos about space, obviously. And the one that kind of caught our attention is about Enceladus. And it's, of course, that's a moon of Saturn. And the thing that's kind of cool about that, and she kind of talks about it in a fun way, it's the shiniest body in our solar system. Shiniest meaning most reflective. And it also has a few oddities like geysers, but also heat signatures on it in a cerdation form, which is probably coming from geothermic reactions inside the planet. It's made of mostly water, and so we have hot water out around Saturn, which means...
Or at least not ice that's close to absolute zero, which is
right.
What things
no,
are
we,
in Saturn. Yeah.
There's warmth for it to be potentially liquid. Of course, that can also happen from just compression, but that we won't get into that. In any case, her video is kind of fun. She has a whole channel, and of course, she's getting supported by Patreon, as do we, which is cool. Dee Dee, thanks for bringing her to my attention, because I love some space news.
It really is pretty to look at, especially when you break it down into how it's basically this sort of glowing snowball of a moon with little tiger stripes on it that show little thermal vents, which would provide an energy source if, say, we actually found life on Enceladus. And one of the other facts that from the video that we shouldn't leave out, because it's really important whenever you're talking about potential life on other bodies in our solar system, would be that the likelihood that it would be sort of a spinoff of life on Earth, it's more probable that this is like a second genesis of life, because of the amount of matter that we share with Saturn, as since it's so much further out than even Jupiter. It's so small that if we found life, it would be most likely that this would be new life, not a remix of Earth life.
A second spawn, if you will. Unlike if we found life on Mars, most likely that would be from the same genesis and probably actually from Mars to Earth because of the way the solar system cooled and such.
That, and they've seen impacts that have hit Mars in early life and then pieces of Mars found its way to Earth.
Right. But that doesn't happen between Saturn and us because it's so far out.
Well, that and Jupiter is a giant vacuum cleaner for the solar system.
Right.
So anything that got out of its way had to pass Jupiter's orbit, and that is
hard
non-trivial.
To do. Yeah, right, right.
That's one of the reasons why we don't get bombarded as hard as we could, perhaps.
Because we got Jupiter.
It's because Jupiter's there.
Thanks, God.
Which is funny. This reminds me of some other space news
that
I had completely forgotten about, but there have been Jupiter flybys. They've taken some very beautiful South Pole pictures in true color, and they are these bright blue bottoms,
mm-hmm.
and that's just the color of the bottom of Jupiter.
Oh, cool,
it's
I didn't
awesome.
Know that. That's awesome.
And in addition to that, Voyager 1
still
is officially outside of our solar system.
Completely outside of solar system.
Yeah, it is no longer at the boundary point. It is past the boundary. It is officially in interstellar space.
Somebody should write like a sci-fi novel about an alien race finding that. Oh, wait. There's a few of those. That's cool that we finally made it out of the solar winds, if you will.
Or back in the day when we thought that there was going to be a Voyager 6.
Yes.
Star Trek, the motion picture.
They used Voyager 6, huh, as the plot point.
Voyager.
So take a look at Errol's stuff, and you will find the yep. beautiful photos to put on our show notes. And, of course, you can find our show notes. This is the April 5th show episode of GeekSpeak 2017, if you want to find it online. Of course, while you're online, go ahead and visit our support page and take a look at how you might be able to support us. You don't have to do a lot, just a little. Everything helps. And speaking of videos, because her videos, of course, there's also a really great video that Greg sent our way. Would you describe this video of the pianist?
First off, I have to say I'm really sad that I never learned how to play piano.
I thought you said earlier today that you were playing piano now.
Well, I mean, I'm able to play the basic one-finger version of Do, Re, Mi.
So basically you know what keys in what order when you're doing a C scale.
When I was younger, I played a little bit better, but I never actually truly played the piano.
I have forcefully made my children play piano, and all of them are upset at me, but can play.
One might say I have pianist envy. Ooh.
Please leave the room.
But at any rate, one of the things that people do for websites is eye tracking. People do that when they're following mice, but they also put glasses on people to be able to track their eye movement.
To be clear, websites don't do this. There's a piece of hardware that you wear on your face that does the eye tracking.
Yes.
They use that type of hardware when doing studies on how people use websites.
Yes.
Websites don't track your eyes.
Okay.
Any case, yes. And that's used for kind of assessing how a UI works.
Well, and how people react to that UI, how they react to information. One of the things I had never seen before, and I was so glad that Greg brought this article up, was putting these eye tracking glasses on a professional pianist and his student.
And this video shows what he's looking at.
Yes, where his eyes go. It reminded me very much of what would happen with someone who hunt and pecks on a typewriter versus a touch typist. You know, where the professional pianist who's been playing for over 30 years, you know, his eyes are at the bottom of the page of music.
Mm-hmm.
Only he scans a little bit through the music, but in general, he has everything in his peripheral vision. And he never really stares at the keys on the keyboard. It's quick little tracks down to the keyboard. He was looking, his focus was fairly fixed and was kind of in a zone in between the top of the keyboard and the bottom of the sheet music. His eye didn't move very much. It was kind of a track where his hand will be.
Yeah.
But
cool.
It still wasn't that much movement. It was very much peripheral vision. Yeah, and then his student.
Mm.
And you saw a lot more eye movement, especially up and down keyboard.
And he actually critiqued her a bit on the eye movement, uses a tool of education, which is kind of neat.
Yeah. That and also just commented, the longer you spend, the more comfortable you get with the keyboard, the less you have to look at it. And that's why I made that analogy with touch typing.
Yeah.
Like after a while, you really don't have to look at the keyboard anymore. It is just muscle memory. You know, you don't think anymore about, I need to hit a P.
Right.
You just hit it.
Right. Hey, you and I are not pianists. And Didi, have you ever played piano? Are you a piano player?
Yeah, I took piano lessons. My piano teacher gave us sort of grade levels. I think I made it to about the third grade.
We are not piano players, and at least not professionally, but we are professional web developers. All three of us know a lot about web development. And we've been doing it for quite a while. I think I've been doing it longer than you, Miles.
I seriously doubt that.
Really? Why is that?
Are you... My first professional gig making a web page was in 1995.
1995 professionally as a web?
Yeah.
You beat me by like 6 months or a year.
It might have been early 1996, but I think it was still 1995.
I mean, I had a web page for myself, a vanity page in 96.
No, I was actually getting paid for it.
Are we really going to measure whose HTML is longer here?
One of the things that the reason why I was able to get jobs early on, and probably one of the reasons why Miles hired me and such, is that my HTML was all hand-coded, and I love the structure of URLs, and I care about the URL path. I mean, in general, web pages, like, the aesthetic of the entire thing is important to me. I want well-formatted HTML source. I'm okay if it's, like, minified and stuff. That's fine. Not that you do much to that with HTML. But in any case, this project's come along that everybody's touting as this new great wave of speeding up web pages. And the project is called AMP, Accelerated Mobile Pages. And it's a project from Google. And Didi or Miles, can you guys explain how it works?
Basically, what they've done is they have taken best practices for the mobile web. In other words, you don't have much in the way of scripting, certainly no blocking scripts at the beginning. You have minimal CSS. In fact, a lot of times CSS is moved to someplace later. You're not blocking the rendering path so that it can you can show the page as quickly as possible. It keeps things lightweight. You have a guard on how much stuff you can put onto the page, keeps sizes small. So you can make something that's equivalent to an AMP page without actually using AMP, which is also a custom API you put in as some metadata in a certain format as well.
Let's talk about the general steps that make sense. When I first heard about AMP, I just thought it was a practice of making web pages such that, you know, you do things like stylize your HTML so that it renders without any CSS at all. And then you don't even have to load the CSS until after the page is rendered once. That way, you're not required to get the extra content. That's a standard thing you could do in any web page.
Right, except that the AMP has specific rules about what markup is allowable and what markup is not and what CSS is allowable and what is not.
So AMP has a guideline for this? How does it enforce this?
If a page does not follow that guideline, then Google doesn't cache it.
Okay. So this is a big step of this. The big part of this is that when you design these pages in this form, Google will validate it and cache it. Will it actually cache your content?
The caching is optional, okay, but many people do use it. The page gets scraped by Google and then served off of Google servers.
So part of the protocol of AMP is telling Google servers, you can cache this page for a period of time, and then Google will actually use its massive CDN, Content Delivery Network system, mm-hmm, to cache and deliver fast. So
again, that's optional, but yeah.
Right. So for example, if we use this, the GeekSpeak site, a GeekSpeak site is running on one DigitalOcean instance in San Francisco, and so anytime anyone hits that, they have to traverse the entire web to hit that box. If we were to amplify, if we will, these pages, then Google would have a copy of that anywhere in the world. And then when the person asks for the website, it would actually get the copy and it'd be a lot faster.
Right.
Didi, what's your feeling on AMP?
I sure feel like they ran away with a fork of HTML. And sort of like one of the main things that bothers me is these walled gardens that keep getting created for content publishers to jump through various hoops to get their content and their articles and their pages and their stories actually in front of the people that they're trying to reach. So like even if you were a popular blog and your fans wanted to get all your content on Facebook, for example, because AMP is really, really close relative of like Facebook's instant articles, Facebook controls almost every aspect of that program, and so it's sort of like asking content publishers to live by their rules.
Yeah,
and that seems to be very antithetical to like the very old curmudgeon-y, the web is for everybody. Anybody can get their content out there and be readable by other people. Person inside me from like traversing the internet in the 90s, and also with AMP and these in-app only articles that you can see on inside Facebook's apps. It's just sort of the idea that a link is something that you can share and that it represents
the canonical truth.
Path.
Yeah.
The canonical truth, the path to that content is sort of blowing up. I see lots of people trying to share articles. They copy the link dutifully and they post it in Twitter or whatever, and then you get all this boilerplate in front of what is not really the URL to the actual content, the actual site. It's the sort of cached, amplified link. And so, say Google decides this doesn't work out later, all those AMP links are not going to work, but that content might still be up. Like, the Washington Post is using these, so you're seeing like these sort of middle ground Washington Post amplified links instead of Washington Post links.
Yeah, my concern with it is they're breaking the web, or at least they were at first release.
Has it changed since first release? Because I don't notice what Didi has been noticing. I don't notice that as much.
One of the things that I had an issue with AMP pages is I would do a Google search on my phone. You would get these AMP pages, and they would get priority over other ones. And Google said they were going to do this, and okay, fine.
You mean in the search results?
In the search results. And, of course, search results are
the de facto win.
whoever is first in search results is going to get most hits. If you're on the first page, you get the most hits. When I would click on a link, it would load up that page extremely quickly because, I mean, they're being hosted on Google servers. They're using all of the tips and tricks they can do. They're doing the DNS request ahead of time. They're prefetching assets. It's their lickety split. No complaints about performance.
Right.
But then I go, okay, well, I want to post this up onto Facebook. So then I look at the URL, but the URL is essentially a modified Google.com. It's no longer Washington Post or Ars Technica.
Is the root URL in there still?
It kind of mixed in, yes.
Oh, okay.
But it's not something that you can just take away the prefix and then it's there.
But at the same time, in that article, in that amplified thing that you're viewing somewhere, isn't there a link to share it, if you will?
There
and
is
that share
now.
URL. Oh, I yeah. see. The
there
first time
now.
Around it wasn't.
For the first several months that this was out, that was not the case.
Okay. Is Google doing this partially to compete with Facebook's inline story system?
I can't speak to their motives. I think it's also safe to say that part of the motive was just trying to make mobile faster.
So that's the thing that I want to address on this, the benefit of these things. We're ragging on a lot of the things we don't like about it. But the truth of the matter is that people turn away from content because of delay more than anything else. So if the delay doesn't exist, people see the content better. I mean, that's just the fact of the web in general. In that regard, it seems like a win. More people are seeing people's content.
But there is also a push towards making things the verb now to appify.
Yeah.
In other words, you have these walled gardens that is the Google search, and you never really leave Google. You go to Facebook and you go to the news, and you never really leave Facebook.
Right.
When you're seeing a lot of these articles, especially if you're in the app
so,
space or
oh,
the mobile
I see,
space.
I finally see what you guys mean by the walled garden. If you're Google searching and you're getting AMP pages back and you click on them and actually the content's all coming from Google, the individual website never even knows they were visited necessarily.
The metrics do come back. You can
they still get some page views and things like that. It's just that if Google is boosting these AMP pages inside of Google's universe and these pages get priority, you might wind up just sticking inside of the Google bubble there. And if you're looking at instant articles and remaining sticky inside the Facebook app, you're also staying inside that Facebook garden. And especially when you look at Facebook, since even though we're not talking, we didn't launch off because of the Facebook instant articles, but they are kind of related. When you look at Facebook, you have people sort of like, Facebook not wanting to admit that they are a media provider and not taking responsibility for how their algorithms shape what you see and what you don't see. And so if you're getting these instant articles that are in Facebook because content providers are trying to get to where people can actually see their stuff, and it's just reinforcing all the things that we talked about in past shows and over the last like 6 months about bubbles and how that's reinforcing biases and
sure.
So you have to really think about how the open web was supposed to combat the lack of diversity,
mm-hmm.
and now we are in the search for convenience and speed. We're giving up some of that diversity and diversity of thinking, and by sort of being beholden to companies and their particular speedy verticals that give them better ad views.
Okay, I want to do another counter for this. If Google were de-associating the CDN quality of this, the caching quality of this, and the AMP system, or would that lessen the concern, or is it more that the whole reason why they have this AMP protocol is so they can do the caching? Are they interlinked?
They have quite a few things that are AMP-specific that are being put into URLs. Like you have a style and the attribute AMP boilerplate. And you have a script tag that is of type application LD JSON, which is a metadata that is made specifically for AMP pages and is not, for example, the open graph that Facebook was doing or the Twitter metadata. And I would have loved if they had piggybacked on top of open graph because that was already there.
Yeah.
People were already using it. And so it creates this whole other ecosystem to say it's a web page, but it's a web page for Google as opposed to – and then other people are making a web page for Facebook. And
it's interesting because they already had to some level helping Google index your site, they've already have a pretty comprehensive way of doing sitemaps, which helps the indexing system figure out what your content is and register it. And Google, of course, is already processing Facebook's metadata system.
OpenGraph.
Thank you. Google's already using that also for content knowledge. And OpenGraph basically is just meta information you put in a web page so that you can do things like when you do a share, it includes a photo. That's part of OpenGraph. I've been putting it on Geekspeak. That's what I was learning about it. And in that regard, they have done that. But this is something else that's kind of redundant of some of that data.
It is absolutely redundant to it.
Part of AMP, not all of AMP, but part of AMP.
Well, the metadata portion of it is completely redundant to existing OpenGraph meta tags.
And I'm assuming that the AMP boilerplate style attribute, style of course is an element in HTML that you use for loading in CSS and declaring. CSS of course stands for cascading style sheets. It's the styling of the web, and the boilerplate attribute in there, AMP boilerplate, I'm assuming says, go ahead and load the basic AMP style sheet, which is some style sheet that the browser is going to load at that point. And Google, of course, will hard cache it in the sense that it will tell the browser always cache the CSS, and it will get loaded from JavaScript. I mean, all of this is just a web app protocol in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, like, this will work on Safari just as much as Chrome.
Yeah.
Interesting.
There is a part that's a curmudgeon, old-timer part of me that is also annoyed with, let's have so much in terms of scripting, especially scripting that we don't control. You are embedding a script that comes from
Google,
from AMP, and from the AMP project, among other things. And they're doing some very good engineering, don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah.
But that idea of it's going to tweak things and have JavaScript put in the CSS just so and do all these things just so, it takes away there's so much magic going on that it takes away the ability for you, the individual user, to be able to recognize and control what's going on. And also, it again puts that dependency on how Google does it, as opposed to
right.
a dependency on, well, I'm going to put CSS in there because that's how this gets painted, and I'm going to put this in.
And we're basically talking about open standards that developed in public view and shared, and that's how our current systems work. Why HTML and CSS and JavaScript all work is because of these open standard bodies, and putting it into the control of one company.
I also feel like this is the wrong way to advocate for thinner pages. You know, like Google's a huge company, and they've done things in the past that have been soft nudges to finding yourself on that first page, that all important page. Like with secure browsing, they've nudged HTTPS content higher up in the results. They've in the past like started doing speed checks against pages and saying that they would optimize toward pages that loaded faster, and
those are all beneficial things.
Those are all beneficial things that help everybody and that aren't any particular like narrowly held standard. They are all things that you could meet inside your own web app while using things like OpenGraph, which are things that more than just Facebook use, and web developers all over the place. I've been adding more and more zing and zazz to pages so that they are heavy and like large, and ad networks are throwing in all sorts of JavaScript at people to the point where there are whole browsers built around blocking it so that things can go a little bit faster. I think everybody left and right is screaming for pages to get suddenly thinner, but also provide a viable business model so publishers can keep creating content. And I don't know if these walled gardens are it, but I think it's kind of a hostile entry.
So what do you think we can do about this as developers and advocates of the free and open web? What do you actually do to counter this?
Well, there are people online who do advocate for the web, both organizations and individuals.
Yeah.
And one of the things that has been a big push of late is recognizing the overabundance of JavaScript to do everything, JavaScript to generate the CSS, JavaScript to generate the markup, so that it's a lot harder to even index a page because everything is JavaScript-driven as opposed to before you made the markup first. There's actually a lot of times where people will put in an on-click handler to be able to take you to a URL. Mm-hmm. And so the big push now is to recognize there's a lot of stuff that HTML can do for you. You don't need this JavaScript. You can just use an A tag. You can just use a radio button.
But if all the developers out there that are all the content providers out there are going, well, I got to play in Facebook's world to get views, and I've got to play with AMP in Google's world to get views, they're going to do that. Unless
yes,
there's some counter technology that will provide the same type of thing but in a different way, they're going to move that direction. And Didi Kanye, what you're saying is, well, all you have to do is build your pages really fast. And the other thing you have to do is get some kind of CDN to deliver your content. Use Akamai or some other content delivery network to deliver content as fast as Google can.
Sort of funnily enough, if everybody creates their own AMP-like project and we add all of these site and application and network-specific things to our pages, people who aren't on those networks are getting even thicker pages.
That's true. All right, we're going to move on to some news that we've been playing with for quite a while now. I think the last 5 shows we've talked about how bad Uber is as a company, but there's more news. So what is Uber's lament?
Well, Uber has a particular lament, which is that they have said they have no Black or Hispanic employees in leadership positions in the company.
They've said this?
Yeah. This is not among drivers.
True.
This is among the...
The execs. Or leadership. Well, managers even?
Yes. Among the...
How many employees do they have?
I don't remember actually how many they have off the top of my head, but it does not include drivers, but it does include the people who work in-house. And it's among the tech, so not the marketing or sales tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And so they found that, for example, Uber's tech employees, 85% male, which...
Now, Google's, you know, in December of this last year, Google's is 81%. So
yes.
It's not that much difference.
Yes. Still horrible. And this is when we talk about a general critique of Silicon Valley. That's pretty horrible.
Yep.
And then when they talk about diversity numbers, it's about 50% white. And
46.2% white for tech jobs. And then 2.4 multiracial, 2.1% Hispanic, 1% Black, and 47.9% Asian. I'm on Uber's diversity page.
Okay.
They must have updated it because I'm looking at the write-up from Ars Technica, and it has it as 49.8 white and 30.9 Asian. But that may be the entire company.
That's overall.
Okay.
If you drill down to just the technical roles, then it's 47.9%.
So overall it's horrible, and then it gets worse.
Yeah, it gets worse. Although if you look at the uber.com/diversity, you'll see lots of diverse faces on the page.
At yeah, least. A lot of diverse models they have there.
Yeah.
People who are modeling the consumers. You'll notice in that when I look at this page where it has a woman getting out of the back seat, she's obviously a writer, not a driver.
Yeah. They're trying to do a lot of press about this. I mean, this Uber diversity site is completely about addressing this issue. And at least they're being transparent about it in the sense that they're sharing their data at this point.
When you look at leadership roles for only the technical roles, it's 75% white and 25% Asian. So it's 0% Black or Hispanic.
For leadership roles?
For leadership roles, specifically.
Pretty bad, Uber. Now, at the same time, this is a problem all over the place. We're kind of picking on Uber because of their horrendous current state of affairs, including things like the CEO having an event at a strip club, not really a strip club, but equivalent.
Might as well have been.
A business event.
Microsoft's done the same.
Yeah. I would not be surprised at all if most tech companies that have been around for 20 years.
I mean, I just, point for point,
yes.
Microsoft has recently had strippers at a company event.
Okay. I mean, obviously, it's not okay. It's kind of gross. Recently.
And the curious thing is, for so many years, hearing people that I was working with say, yeah, it's kind of a problem, but it's not that big of a problem. It's not that big. Like, over and over saying, like, well, I see a whole bunch of people who are, around in our particular group. Or, they look at me and go, hey, there's
some
different.
Hey, we got a black guy.
Yeah. But at the same time, one of the good things about the push to get the data from these companies, Uber gets a little bit of credit for releasing this, but then again, they've also been getting a whole lot of flack because they hadn't been releasing this information for a long
mm-hmm.
time, that people have said for a long period of time, well, I just, we're data driven. We're going to go, we're going to be based upon data. We're going to see the data and then we're going to act on it. And now we're getting all of this data, but I'm not seeing the action to go along with it.
The places where you see more effective change, like if you look at Intel, they actually tie their diversity goals with bonus and compensation. So they're actually putting money behind their words, and it's actually caused improvements.
Mm-hmm.
So they've reached closer to they've reached their goals the last couple of years in, of hiring at least 40 or 45% new hires being women, and other underrepresented minorities. So they're very careful
this is
to
Intel?
Avoid the
yeah.
yeah they're very careful to avoid using the word quota. And or saying that these are quotas, these are hiring goals, and they are backing them up with bonuses.
Right.
So, it's coming from the top down, so that's also important. And then they're actually saying we value this in monetary amounts. So,
can I use my white ignorance here with you guys and try to get some clarity on something?
That could be a little dangerous, but okay.
I'm planning on it being dangerous. I'm sticking out here. Okay, so one of the goals of diversity is not just about being good humanitarian or something. There's also a benefit in the ability for a diverse set of people to come up with new ideas. You know, the diversity actually has a benefit in the sense that you're not isolated to one problem solution,
or to see problems that you wouldn't normally see. Yeah.
Right, and that's not, I'm not just talking about being fair. I'm about human beings and treating everybody fair. I'm talking about actually getting a benefit from a diverse workforce. And you'll just have different things come up. So if that is a benefit for the company, then and you have a extremely like 81% male engineering force, why not pay more money for female engineers? I mean, there aren't as many female engineers working right now in Silicon Valley. So if you said, and I'm just using female and male just as a way of having some kind of discussion, there is not as many female engineers in Silicon Valley as male engineers in Silicon Valley. So therefore, there are as from a commodity perspective, they are worth more potentially for the company. So why not just pay female engineers more?
Assuming you don't have a culture of trying to pay people as little as you can so that you can have executives get higher bonuses. But
with a group of people in Silicon Valley, and people were like, ooh, that's offensive, and I would hate that. Why am I wrong?
I've heard this argument actually just recently. There were a bunch of tweets today pointing out that women tend to wind up in jobs that are well within their skill set, that they can sort of over-deliver on.
They're safe jobs?
Not necessarily safe, but they're over-qualified for the positions that they generally are in at present. So, and they're also undercompensated usually in those roles. So if you just paid women who are already doing the work now more, you'd probably be getting more. Yeah, because they also said something to the effect that, like, it started this whole thread of, like, yeah, I remember when I left my job, they took three people to replace me. They tend to not know how much the effect the women doing the work are until they're gone and you have to fill their roles. And it was sort of illuminating because you have this when you do deep dives into the research and what retention problems there are and what advancement issues people hit when they get to the middle of their career.
Mm-hmm.
You see a lot of people who stagnate because they don't get their promotions, because they don't get to go into those back rooms where people are having dinner and shaking hands and making the deals, either because they're not allowed to eat dinner with people that aren't their wives or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or the company decides it's a good idea to go to a strip club.
Right.
Or the company decides it's a good idea to go to a strip club, or they're always after hours and you have to, you know, go and live the rest of your life like a normal human being. But yeah, like, women are generally overcompensated and overqualified for their position.
Undercompensated and overqualified.
Sorry, yes.
Let me put this another way, a more straightforward and kind of offensive way. And that is, right now, Uber, the numbers they're passing out for their tech race and ethnicity in the U.S. for tech employees is 1% black, okay? So why not just for them to say, well, we have to get our number of black employees in the tech field to 20%. And therefore, we are going to do some kind of calculated ratio where we give everyone that's black a 20% overcompensated pay than anybody else, and that number will decrease until the numbers are balanced in the hiring, you know. Does that seem ridiculous? Because that would achieve what they want.
That, I think, is shifting the conversation in a way that becomes adversarial for the people coming in. Uber has systemic problems, and not just Uber, but I mean, Uber is the one we're talking about right now, have systemic and deep-seated problems with regard to women, and it would not surprise me if it also extended to people of color.
From their hiring stats, it looks
and
like it.
So I don't think that just throwing money at the problem will solve it, especially because you're going to – if you have such a toxic bro culture like that, it's highly likely that if you put someone in that position, like if I were to get hired by Uber, for example, with this 20%
right
bump, that you would – you're fostering an environment where I would have a fair number of people going – oh, you get paid a whole bunch, and
but keep
you're not
in
really
mind that
it.
Right now it's already an offensive place. It's already a hard place for you to get a job, right? I mean, we're just balancing this off our numbers.
I think to get a job at Uber would be pretty easy for me right now.
Right, but you see, what I'm saying is that it's difficult because who would want to go there? It's a crappy place to be. You're not going to want to go there. But oh, you know what? We know it's hard. We know it's bad. And we know we're doing things wrong. So please come in and kind of help us. We'll pay you 20% more. I mean, isn't that or is that just so gross from the perspective of balance? Because here's the thing. We currently have a male white culture in Silicon Valley. And until you put money as a difference, I don't see that changing fast. Now,
well, I mean, some of this goes back to the age-old idea of, like, who really is going to be the driving force behind fixing racism? Is it going to be the people that are privileged and have all of the power, or is it going to be the people that are oppressed by racism? Is it going to be the people that are oppressed by sexism that overcome like these misogynist ideas, or is it going to be like a collaborative effort, or is it that men and white people and et cetera are going to have to step in and really do the work?
Well, change only happens from a collaborative social change, right? Everybody has to participate in the change for it to occur.
Right, but that first part of change is also that denial stage, and I still think that we're in the denial stage. Before you can even get to the problem, you have to acknowledge that the problem exists there in the first place. Like, we have the data that says that our current hiring practices don't work. Whiteboarding isn't a good predictor.
Right.
The way that we choose to hire people is not predictive of their overall performance as time goes on.
And to be clear, I just saw a whole talk on this about what is a good predictor on success, and we just are really, really bad at it. We don't have very good predictors. One, of course, the highest percentage was like a 50%, a 0.5, if you will, predictor rate, which is still abysmal, because that means that half the time you're getting it wrong either direction.
Right.
Working in the job for like 6 months, that's the best predictor we have right now at 54.54 of a success rate, which still, what I'm saying is 50% of the time you're completely wrong either direction. That's pretty bad. It's really hard to find good employees.
Right. Now,
or to find good matches.
I have seen people that are otherwise intelligent that I get along with that have said straight up that they have seen the stats say that, you know, we don't hire correctly, and they accept that.
Mm-hmm.
And then only a few minutes later will also say, well, we don't have women or more people of color because it's a pipeline problem. The implicit assumption that the people that are there don't have the same level of experience and ability level, even though we have the data that says we can't predict that correctly.
Right.
And there's a really interesting facet of the tech industry that refuses to see the contradiction between those two positions.
Right.
I really like that we're having this conversation more about diversity over the last course of the years. People are putting out numbers, even though some of the people are late to the game, like Uber. But as we go through the conversation, it's really important to recognize that there are no easy, simple problems to this. It's going to be really hard work, because we thought that doing training on unconscious bias was going to help, but mm-hmm. that seemed to be giving people more of a reason to dig into their biases. Like, oh, it's not your fault that you're this way. It's unconscious. And actually, it has caused some people to become even more biased.
Yeah. That's what the studies show. It's hard to believe that, but that's what the studies actually show.
We're going to have to do the hard work, do the hard talking, do a lot of honest like looking into it, have lots of numbers to back up what we're doing, but it's not going to be easy. It's not like going to be like I'm going to give you cookies every time you get something right and like bat you over the head when you do something wrong. Because who am I to decide everything that is right and wrong as a black person, you know?
Okay, let me try to go back to the same question that I asked before and ask in a different way. You understand completely that you would hire someone that has more expertise on a subject at a higher level than someone's junior. So someone right out of college, junior software engineer, versus someone that has 10 years or more experience, like a senior software engineer like you, Miles, that this pay rate for those two people are going to be different, right? Because one benefits the company in more ways than the other.
It depends upon what their skill sets are, what the focus is. But,
in general, you could say that, right? You right out of college versus you 10 years later, if you've shown success in the company, in different companies, you're worth more. Okay. You're not a better human being or any of that kind of stuff. You just are worth more to the company because the company can get more value from you, right?
It's presumed that you have more experience and you've learned all the things that don't work.
But the reason why the company wants to do it is that they're going to benefit more from you than a junior engineer. If they were going to benefit exactly the same amount, then you're worth the same amount of money. They wouldn't pay you differently.
Right.
Like, that's the whole point of the pay. Okay. So you and I have effectively the same amount of experience in the work industry, right? In software engineering. We have different skill sets, definitely. But we have the same distance of experience.
We have
a lot of overlap, but we have some similarities. So you and I, theoretically, from a general perspective, if you looked at our resumes or whatever, we'd probably have the same salary range. But you have a secondary benefit that I do not have for a company that is missing diversity, especially in like black or multiracial areas. You fulfill something that I cannot fulfill. I'm bringing to the table the same white male perspective as the rest of the 90% engineers, whatever, 45% engineers. And you're bringing something that is not as common for that company. And therefore, aren't you worth more to the company?
There's an interesting thing that you're touching on, because when you talk about individuals, it's much harder to quantify like that. In the large, that is true. On an individual basis, you really can't make those distinctions to say that one person is worth more than another.
I totally agree with you.
That said, there is an extra pressure, I think, that I have when I'm at a job than what you have. When you have a culture that is more like yourself, there is less chance for conflict or misunderstanding or for that fit in, which are habits, which are cultural history might be, the TV shows that you watch, the things like that.
Just, sure.
There is also never that worry, which I have felt. I can't speak for you, Didi, but I have felt of if I'm the only black guy around – and I don't do well, am I
representational?
Yeah. Am I going to be treated as though I'm representational as opposed to an
individual? Oh, right. So people would go, oh, that's okay.
If you mess up, and you have messed. Everyone has messed up at some point in their job, done something that was that was bad.
Sure.
Like you go like, oh, crap, I just totally screwed that up. You know, how often do you say, well, crap, are they going to be more worried about hiring white people in the future?
I never think that way. I never have to think that way because the privilege I have.
If someone is rude to you or is dismissive of you or whatever, have you ever thought, might it be not because of who I am as an individual, but who I appear as part of a group?
Yes, obviously that's happened. Not in the workforce, but growing up in Santa Cruz as a boy, yeah, sure.
But I guess I'm thinking about in the tech industry because we are
in
talking
the tech
about
the industry. Absolutely not. That's never like I don't think somebody's being rude to me in a meeting or not paying attention to me because I'm male or white. No, that never crossed my mind.
Right.
But for you, you're going to sit in a meeting sometimes and someone maybe not pays attention to you and you go, I wonder if that's because they're a jerk or because I'm not saying something correctly or because I happen to be black.
If I had a dollar for every time I said something and then 20 minutes later somebody said the same thing and suddenly everybody paid attention, I would not have to work.
I see that happen even for myself. I have to consciously be aware of who has said what and how I repeat or add on to what they say. If it's a female that's brought up a point, even if I was thinking about it beforehand, but she brings it up, I then have to make sure to say in the beginning of what I'm saying, Anne's point is really valid and maybe we should extend that if that makes sense to you. I'll normally end that with passing it back to her because it was her idea. Without doing that, then I'll get credit automatically. And it's, of course, if I'm not conscious of that in the meeting, it will happen accidentally. I'll go, oh, crap, that just happened. So I have to be extra careful about how I say things in meetings so I'm not taking credit for other people's work.
Right. And I know so many people that have said, but I end up having to walk on eggshells. I have to be extra careful to make sure that I'm not saying something that's going to infringe upon someone else, that's going to dismiss someone else, something like that. I have to go through all of this effort, have been couched in those terms.
Yeah.
And without the realization that most women that I've known in the tech industry, most people who are not, you know, cis, that are, you know, or people of color, constantly have to moderate their speech and their mannerisms and their interactions
to do the same thing
in order to just meet what is considered by many to be the neutral.
Right.
Have to go through that extra effort.
And to be clear, when I do that in a meeting, in no way am I resentful that I have to do that. I find it gross that it has to be done.
Right, but there are a lot of people who are. There are a huge number of people who are actively resentful of having to put that
extra
effort.
We're talking about like two different levels. Like one level is to make sure I don't, you know, use offensive jargon and slang. Like I remember as a kid, I used to, you know, say Indian giver. And until I was told, you know, what that comes from, and I was like, oh, and learned how offensive it is, I don't use that term anymore, right? And there's a lot of terms in my life as a child I used and have learned how wrong they were. At no time am I'm like, oh, well, maybe at some point in my life I was resentful for having to give up some words or some ways of talking. But over time, as I've learned that, I just appreciate the depth of how to be respectful, you know? And that's one stage. That's what I'm thinking most of the time people are upset about is, oh, I'm just being friendly. I don't really mean that word, you know, that kind of style. This is like a secondary level. This is like overthinking everything so that you can help not be a part of the problem. And that is, I don't know how many people actually do that. If more people did it, then it would go away. Like this problem would disappear.
It hurts to think that you might be doing something bad. I mean, like, shame is real, and it's not a happy emotion.
Yeah.
And it's a reason for a lot of the problems that we have is people do not like to think of themselves as the bad person, especially when they did not intend to be. And so that's where you have this switch of, no, this behavior must be acceptable because I wasn't trying to be a bad person.
Yeah.
And I'm not a bad person. So the logical conclusion must be that this is acceptable.
Oh. And I've had arguments about this and been on the wrong side of those arguments in my life. We do this thing at Netflix called 360s, which is basically a yearly review. You're supposed to give feedback to your colleagues. And it is a very challenging thing to do because you're supposed to be extremely honest and very short, because a lot of people are going to get a lot of these things, right? Especially managers and stuff. They're going to get like 80 of these things. And they're basically, you know, a couple paragraphs, 10 sentences to help the person be better as an employee. A very simple thing is, you know, stop coming to meetings late. That's all you'd say, right? You might give a reason for it. You know, it shows disrespect for the people and waste our time, right? And that's all you'd say. And things, they're all over the place in this realm, and they're very challenging to do. So in this internal podcast I'm doing, I interviewed the woman that runs HR for a big division, and she does a lot of these things. And I said, you know, it's very hard to do this. And she said, yeah, but the truth – and I said, well, what does it feel like to you when you get feedback that you're screwing up? You know, you're getting feedback from your colleagues that you've done something wrong, or you repeatedly do something wrong. And it's core to who you are. It's how you say hello to people, or it's how you comment on people's issues. It's a serious problem with you, a deficit that's causing problems. How do you take that? And she said, you know, at first it was hard, but the truth is that's happening anyway. It's painful anyway. You're hurting people. You're doing something wrong anyway. At least if you're told, you have an opportunity to change that. And that is a highly enlightening way of thinking about it, of course, because it is egotistically damaging to get people to say, you're screwing up all the time, you're bad in this way. But they think it anyway, just hidden. So it's better to know it, right, and to be able to compensate for it than to be – and to be able to hopefully change.
I used to think that, and then the country changed a lot in the last year and a half with more people being very open about it, and it's a very different feeling when there's a lot of encouragement for that.
For what?
People being really honest about all their biases.
See, I'm not talking about being honest about your bias. I'm talking about being honest about how people are acting and how they can change that to be better at what they do. So it would be, you know, your flippant racism is in a, you know, is wrong. It hurts me every time you do that. And for the person to listen to it and change. I don't think a lot of people have the ability to listen to things and change about themselves. I just hitting off of what you'd said a second ago, Miles, where when you're told you're wrong, you want to fight that. You want to, your first reaction wants to be, no, I don't mean to be bad, so it's not bad that I'm doing that. And this is really about getting to the level where you can hear that and figure out how to try to change yourself.
This was an argument I had at Google, as a matter of fact, with a group of people when we talked about racism. And I was talking about some particular item. I think it was prompted by a current events news item where I said, you know, that is racist. And I got a tremendous amount of pushback from people going like, what? That's not – because in their mind, racism was I believe that my race is superior to yours and I'm going to voice that. And I was saying, no, there are many different levels. Like I can be racist myself, and it doesn't mean that I am trying to do that. It's when Didi, when you were talking about implicit bias, that there is you can't live in the world and not be caught up in its wake.
If you're not actively working against institutions and innate biases and the existence of like patriarchy and racism, then you're complicit in a part of it.
Yep.
Because it's everything, especially when you look at any base American institution, it's
there.
Right. You can't be thrown in the pool and not get any water in your mouth.
And it's interesting that you say that, Didi, like the idea of if you're not actively combating it, you are condoning it. That means you have to figure out how to actively combat it.
You have to learn to recognize it.
You have to learn to recognize it. That's the first step, sure. Yeah. Didi, you said institutional bias and inherent bias, and to be clear, we're also talking about individual bias. What's that great website that allows to show your biases? I'll have to look it up. I'll link to the site. I think I've done it before on GeekSpeak. But basically, it's like you take a speed test on different words, and the words are, you know, the gender one is kind of about female versus male and workplace versus home and whether you associate those words if you look at them, if you access them quickly on a keyboard. And basically people just associate, in our society, people associate male with work and female with home, much more so. I did the test recently and definitely happened that way.
That goes back to some of that training that we were just talking about has just shown up that's not as effective as we thought it would be and sometimes reinforces the same biases that it's trying to point out. But they do talk about
even those tests.
It makes it apparent what's going on in your mind, but doesn't necessarily stop you from doing it.
Oh, but then people say, "Oh, everyone's like that, so I don't have to do anything about it." Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's sort of an easy out, which is why it has to be like active in your life. You are trying to overcome these systems,
right? And this was a conversation I was having with those fellow employees. Where I was saying that, like, you can be racist and not necessarily a bad person. Like, you can have these tendencies and then recognize them and try to work against them. And that doesn't mean you're not a racist. You are. You have these impulses to act in a certain way, or you can be sexist. I know that I am sexist and that I say things or I act in ways that are almost, you know, undeniably sexist. Mm-hmm. The question of whether or not I'm a bad person or not, I think, is defined by whether or not I'm actively trying to do better.
Yeah.
Whether I'm trying to recognize those instances and try to do better.
Oh, I totally get that. I mean, I am a black, gender non-conforming, sort of genderqueer person. And even within the working out the spectrum of gender, I've gone on my own journey where I was less than tolerant of the varying definitions that people were coming to understand about their own identities. It was like whether people presented like femme enough or masculine enough, or opinions about how you or which pronouns to use, even if there was like a way to say, these pronouns are obviously better than those pronouns. And it's like, really, it's like, if somebody named Robert asks you to call them Bob and you still call them Robert, you're being a jerk. So if somebody asks you to use particular pronouns and you don't use them, then like, it's the same thing. Like, but you know, you talked to me 10 years ago and I might have argued with you about it. Yeah. And that's not something that I feel great about. And I'm also admitting it in public, but like, it just brought up a little bit of that shame feeling that we were just talking about. Because that's not great.
Yeah, and that was the sticking point with those fellow employees, was I was using racism as, this is this blanket thing that this is the waters, these are the waters that we are swimming in.
Right.
And you can't not get wet. And so at the same time, using the word racist or sexist for them was, wait, but if you are a racist, you are a bad person. If you are a sexist, you are a bad person. I don't think I'm a bad person, and I don't think, and they, you know, would come up with their definition of what racist,
sure,
is, what a racist is, or what a sexist is. And if they didn't fit that definition that they have decided for themselves, then they weren't that.
Well,
and
so,
me,
Miles,
bringing up that
is, isn't it easier to, since the racist and sexist have such heavy connotations? You know, like the bad guy in the movie is racist, right? Since it has such socially hard connotations to accept, isn't it easier to say racially biased and, you know, gender biased?
Well, I can prove that there are more syllables right then and there. So, no, it's not easier to say. When you say racially biased, then someone starts asking, oh, what does that mean? And then you get into a whole question, does that mean racist? Because that you always end up back,
well,
to there,
say,
with the definition.
No, so you say, yeah, I totally agree with you. I think you say, yes, it is racist. It's deciding on things based off of race. That's what the word means, right?
Right. And now you're getting into the definitions. Now you're getting into, you have to explain all of the vocabulary that you were using that you may have cultivated over your lifetime. Every single time you want to have a conversation, which then stifles the whole conversation. Because if I want to say the problem with white people, and when I say that, I mean that as a shorthand. And I'm not saying I think all white people are racist jerks that all do X, Y, and Z. Of course not. Like, no rational person who is not extremely racist believes that everyone of a certain skin tone believes that everyone else of a different skin tone is X, Y, or Z. But I use it as a shorthand for the systemic racism we have in our society, which is largely perpetuated by people of Caucasian descent.
Yeah, but you're going to turn people off if you use that terminology. Because people that are not aware of their own privilege, they're white people in the world that are not aware of their own privilege and how reverse racism is not really a thing, and it's ridiculous to talk that way. If you use that terminology, they translate that easily to as a binary, where if I said the problem with black people, like,
right, except that in this,
you understand that a lot of white people will not be able to hear you say that.
I understand that. And at the same time, within the society we have now, there is no easy way to talk about that.
I agree.
Systemic racism without using some of these pieces of shorthand. Because
I agree.
If you have to talk about them in the longhand every single time, and the definitions take up the entire conversation and you never actually discuss anything.
And I think
if you wanted to break this section of the diversity conversation down to a Googleable term, listeners, you should look up white fragility.
There's another aspect of this, and that is that we're not taught to talk about this in an effective way. Our society shuns the idea of talking about racism in general or racial bias.
That's true of any society, that we don't have the language to describe the most egregious faults of our societies. I mean, this is true everywhere.
We don't even honestly talk about it in history.
Yeah. And I recall as I've gotten to know you, Miles, early on in my relationship, I did not want to talk to you about race. I was all nervous and scared about it. And as I got more comfortable talking with you, and we've had lots of conversations about race at this point, I've gotten a better vocabulary, a better way to think about it, a way to talk about it.
Yeah.
I mean, prior to really being friends with you, I definitely would have seen the problem with white people. I would have been in that complete camp of, well, that's just reverse racism.
Yeah,
I would have totally been there, but you helped educate me to some level.
Well, there is the Urban Dictionary alternative, which is white people.
White people? The problem with white people, white people?
Yeah.
White people.
Yeah.
White people?
Yeah.
W-Y-P-I-P-O.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, you know, that onomatopoeia, you know. Anyway, at any rate, I'm going to out you on this one. This was 10 years ago.
Feel free. Like, I'm a different person now.
We were riding along in your white Volkswagen Rabbit.
Was it important that it was white?
No, just as we're driving along, just giving a time scale
for him. No, it's important
that
it's a rabbit.
It's the convertible one, so it's called something else, but go on.
Or a cabriolet.
Yeah.
Just to give him some context as to when this was.
This was when we lived in L.A.
No, this was in Santa Cruz.
Oh, okay.
And we were riding, I think we were riding together, carpooling on the way to the station.
Okay.
At any rate, we're in the car, we're going, and Lyle turns to me and says, you know, I think you're the only black person I know. I immediately started laughing out loud.
I think I didn't say no. I think I said friend.
Yes, sure. At which point I brought up your childhood friend that you spent years with going through school. I brought up Dee Dee, who you were working, you know, in close proximity to on a daily basis. And for some reason, it didn't register to you.
Yeah, why is that?
That is, in a nutshell, where race lives in our country right now.
How could I recognize that you were black and not recognize how many that I knew black people in my life?
It's like this study where you ask participants in a room of 100 people if there are a lot of women, like majority women in the room, and there's really like 30%, and the men are like, oh gosh, there's totally a lot of women here, and the women are like, no.
But there's an inverse, isn't it? Wouldn't I think that I knew more black people than I did? Like, I don't. What's your
thing,
point?
Though,
what's your point on this story?
My point
is, you've teased me about this before, but I never really understood what the point is about it.
People have a, for lack of a better word, a conceit about their own capacity to recognize their surroundings, and this is a universal human problem. And our expectations about how something is. And our own internal narrative shape what we see in such a way that it defies reality.
So what do you think the narrative that I had was that was shaping it?
You had an idea of, I think, anyway, of race in terms of culture, of manner of speaking, and stuff like that. I think at the same conversation, I brought up the term moted. Yeah, you moted.
Yeah.
And you looked at me like, what? What?
What does that
mean?
That's not
a word. Like, yes, it's totally a word. It's a word that is that I constantly used in my youth, and you had never heard it before. It never. You were immediately disbelieving that it was.
I mean,
that
my stance on that perspective, and I'll get back to that in a second. Mm-hmm. But my stance on perspective was, you know, the high school I went to, there was probably 250 graduating students in one class. You know, my mm-hmm. graduate class. There was one black guy, right? I mean. It was just a very white culture. It's still, still the place we live right now. You and I both live in that area. It's a little bit more diverse than it was, but so it's not it was unusual for me to interact with people with black people. So when I was said you're like my first, my only black friend, spent that as we're driving together, and you're like no, and you start listing
Emerson,
all these different people. I mean, he's in a different class.
It could also be what in your brain. Black meant at that moment, like
I think that's what Miles is getting to. Yeah, exactly.
If you think that at that moment black meant this is a black friend of mine who I've been close to who teaches me about black things, then maybe Miles fit that in a way that I and other black people in your life did not.
Right. So I never talked about racism and black society, if you will, with anybody else. And so you were my only black friend. That kind of makes sense.
I think when we talked, we were mostly talking about work and Apple stuff and coding and...
Or queer culture, for that matter.
And games, yeah. And I was probably more your queer friend.
Yeah, maybe that's the slot you filled in my mind.
I think of the movie Do the Right Thing, just because everyone can be on the same page with that one. Most people have seen that movie. It's Spike Lee.
Oh, it's Spike Lee's movie, yeah.
Yeah, where he stars in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a scene where you have David Turturro, or is that his name? Turturro? Anyway, talking about how he hates black folks in a less polite manner.
Yeah.
And Spike Lee's character comes up to him and goes,
can I talk to you for a second? What? Pina, who's your favorite basketball player?
Magic Johnson.
Who's your favorite movie star?
Eddie Murphy.
Who's your favorite rock star? Prince. You're a Prince
fan. Boss, Bruce.
Prince.
Bruce.
Pino, all you ever talk about is nigga this and nigga that. And all your favorite people are so-called niggas.
It's different. Magic, Eddie, Prince are not niggas. I mean, they're not black. I mean, let me explain myself. They're not really black. I mean, they're black, but they're not really black. They're more than black. It's different.
It's different?
Yeah, to me, it's different.
And he's compartmentalized his disdain for black folks for the things that fit his pre-existing notions. So when something goes outside of that comfort zone, he doesn't recognize it as the thing that he hates because he has the preconceived notion. That's what I meant. It wasn't meant as a personal slight. It was more along the lines of human beings have these many times huge blind spots. And unless we recognize that we have those blind spots, we're not able to even look to any semblance of introspection, to anything that would be productive, unless you recognize that I don't see them.
Blind spot I had when I said that?
That I can be black and queer?
Yeah. What?
First off, I didn't have the convertible when Dee Dee and I worked together because I sold the convertible before I started working at UCSC. So that wasn't the same time.
Okay.
But, you know, I've said it to you many times, so it's very possible that it was after I knew Dee Dee. I don't know.
Okay.
But go back to the point.
When you said my black friend, you're the only black friend I have.
Mm-hmm.
You then had a compartment that was, this is what a black friend is, that I fit in that bucket. Even though there are other people in your life that could have fit in that bucket, you've decided what the bucket was ahead of time.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, it seemed like a pretty valid thing to say at the time. I mean, you listed other people, but they weren't – you listed other people, but they weren't close friends of mine. They weren't friends of mine. Like, you know, the group of people
I
hung out with.
Except as soon as I mentioned the names, you're like
– I was like, oh, yeah.
Oh, right, yeah. Right. I have these friends that are
– Yeah.
You conceded the point in the moment, and now 10 years later, you're going, I don't know if it really applied.
Well, okay, but let's get real here. I'm probably like...
Are we really talking about 2007? when was this car thing?
It was probably 2005, yeah.
No, dude, I didn't have this car when Wyatt was born. That convertible was gone before Wyatt was born. So like 2001. Unless you're like mixing up memories.
2001, I was definitely around then.
No.
Yeah.
No, because I met you after you started the job at Scotty.
Maybe it was 2003. Maybe it was 2003. I don't know.
It's a different car.
Look at my resume?
No. I just know that I didn't have that car when I was working at UCSC. So whatever the year is, it's prior to me working at UCSC.
Okay.
I started working at UCSC in April.
Okay, maybe it was the
jumped
up blue Civic.
It does not matter what car it was. It does not matter. The whole point is that you then said, no, here are all these black people in your life. And I was like, oh, yeah. But keep in mind that for me, it's an egotistical stroke for you to say, no, there's a lot of black people you didn't even notice. Because from my, like, you know, white guilt brain, I'm thinking if Miles points out to me that I'm less or more racially diverse than I thought, that's a benefit.
If you are more colorblind?
If I'm more colorblind, yeah.
Okay.
So,
except that being colorblind is not necessarily a good thing.
I'm not saying that it was a good thought I had. I'm saying I'm justifying the argument of agreement with you.
I said something that probably seems even inflammatory of being colorblind may not be a good thing. Think about your own personal identity. If you are a woman or if you are a man or if you are non-binary or if you are gay or if you are white or black, how much of that has impacted your life? Like my gender has greatly impacted my view of myself, my traipsing through this world, my interaction with others, and my own self analysis. Mm-hmm. So when someone says that I am gender blind, for example, that doesn't make me feel more comfortable. It means that they're not seeing a fundamental part of me.
They're ignorant of their own privilege.
Yeah.
Miles, are you a guy?
I associate myself with male gender. Yes.
Is that what the facial hair is about? And all of the grunting and like measuring how long your HTML is at the beginning of the podcast.
I'm sure that is very much a part of the culture. But yes, yeah. So when someone says they're colorblind, it denies an aspect of me that is a foundational aspect of how I've grown up.
Well, it also means they're blind to their own privilege in regard to whatever that binary they're talking about is, right?
You don't have to think about color if you think that you're the absence of color. You don't have to think about usage of the yellow emoji hand claps as anything but the default because you think you are the default. Or, which is why a lot of white people don't use the white colored hands.
Yeah, or who belongs at a tech company because you feel like you're the default of, you're the norm of who's at a tech company.
Yep. And why the whiteboarding process of interviewing is bad.
I get a lot of surprise sometimes when I reveal my title and what I do for a living. People just don't expect. I mean, even though we're in an industry where everybody goes to work in hoodies and t-shirts and shorts sometimes, like, they still feign surprise that, like, I'm a software engineer.
Do you do hoodies and jeans and shirt?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is its own uniform. If you show up in a, I've done this before, show up in a dress suit and tie to work.
You're not an engineer.
And people are looking at me like, what's going on? What's wrong? When I did this at Puma Tech, I had a coworker say, are you leaving?
Right, right.
Are you going for an interview somewhere?
It's so interesting. If I put on a sweatshirt and jeans in Silicon Valley, obvious software engineer, especially with the mutton chops, because I look like a hipster too. But Didi can wear the exact same thing in Silicon Valley and not necessarily be associated as an engineer.
My current position, at least for another week, sort of, is so weird in this respect. We were actually encouraged to dress up. So, because the founders had like this steampunk proclivity, and so we had Fancy Friday instead of Casual Friday, because everything in tech is Casual Friday
all the time.
So if you show up dressed nicely, people just think, oh, is it Friday? Wait, no, it's not Friday.
I like dressing up. I normally wear a button-up shirt and such at work. I dress up a little bit much, but that's because I'm older and I want to be taken seriously.
You want to show your inner 90s curmudgeon. If you have an iOS device, you should update it. There's a security update.
But I just updated to 10.3 because it had the new file system we talked about last week.
Right, and now you have to update again. You should actually maybe turn auto updates on.
I think auto updates on is a good idea. Though, I got to say, when Miles was trying to get into the building before we started the show, I had decided to install that 3.1 update, and my phone was offline for a while, and he couldn't text me, and it was kind of hard. Miles?
There is a programming language based upon Trump. It's called TrumpScript. Have a link up on the site. That's all I'll say about that for now.
Is it Python-based?
Yes.
Oh, good.
There is a addition for the Galaxy S8 by Samsung, new phone, to use a dock to turn your phone into a desktop computer. Something I've been expecting for many, many years, and now it's finally showed up.
Apple has a patent on that, right, recently. You take a laptop that has a keyboard, and where the trackpad is, you pop an iPhone, and then the computer shell, if you will, is for the iPhone. I mean, that's the patent, so you'd call it an iPhone. I don't know if it's going to necessarily happen.
Right. As you get to phones that are now at the speed of what a Chromebook can do.
The iPhone 7 is more powerful than the thin MacBook One, the one with the one port on it. People call it MacBook One. That the iPhone 7 is a more powerful processor than that machine, which is kind of cool.
I find that.
Well, I heard that. You're going to check the stats? Argue with us. Let us know.
One of the things that's come about is people concerned about their privacy because of the recent laws that have come down and FCC backoffs, and Trump has signed into law that ISPs can collect your browsing history.
Yeah.
This is negated somewhat by going to secure sites. And so I do recommend going to HTTPS when you can. But the curious thing is you can do a Google search over HTTPS so that all your ISP would know is you went to Google.
You talked to Google, sure.
Yeah, not what you searched on. Amazon, same thing. You can say they could see that you went to Amazon, but not necessarily what you purchased at Amazon. New York Times, I can see you went to New York Times, but not what articles you were reading.
Because all these sites use HTTPS.
Yes. Pornhub, people can see that you went to a porn site, but they can't tell what your particular kink is.
So if you do DNS from Google's DNS, oh, you're not DNS sec. Right. So your ISP knows what your DNS queries are.
You also know what your IP address is, and you can do a reverse DNS lookup on that.
Gotcha. Thank you. You just stepped a few ahead. We didn't get to explain that, but okay, we're rushing.
However, if you look up symptoms on WebMD, there is no HTTPS option for that site. So if you're looking up symptoms, your ISP can know that.
So if you're going to look up symptoms, look up for 400 in a night. and have only one of those ones you actually care about.
Do a Google search for them. A lot of times they'll show up just in that search, but then try to go to some place that has HTTPS.
Wow, that's really weird that WebMD doesn't have that.
The Mayo Clinic is also only partially HTTPS.
Can you force URLs to be HTTPS or just some other content?
I think it's because of the ads that they inject. There are a lot of ad networks are still...
Yeah, they got a broken padlock icon.
Wikipedia has HTTPS. They have a lot of good content. So you could do the Google search to find out what it says on WebMD quick enough and then go look up those things.
Yeah, Wikipedia. Yeah, if you look it up there, you can be HTTPS.
So are we negating our earlier curmudgeoniness on Google and staying inside of its walled garden with this nice HTTPS-ness?
Or you can go to DuckDuckGo. DuckDuckGo also supports HTTPS.
No, but if you're clicking on those AMP links that are at the top of Google searches and you never leave HTTPS.
Ah, I see your point.
Oh, man. Our overlords are the only people protecting us from our overlords.
Yeah, news organizations really need to go to HTTPS. For right now, I think a lot of them don't see the need because they want their content to be out as much as possible and they want it to be cached through intermediaries
so
as much as
possible.
So
we've had an SSL cert for over a year on GeekSpeak, but I haven't forced it. I keep on letting it be HTTP as well. I'll go ahead and this week switch it to HTTPS only all the time because then we'll lose a little bit of people. It seems better to participate that
way. Who are we going to lose because of it?
Old browsers. It's possible your browser doesn't support it.
If there's anybody out there still listening in on GeekSpeak on Internet Explorer 8, you should upgrade before Lau does this.
Yeah, but
which is before you have to listen to this episode before he does it, which is after he posts it.
I'll post it.
So why wouldn't you just have they go to HTTP? The only thing that it has in there is redirect to the HTTPS link.
So that won't be the problem. The problem is that our cert chain is secure, and there are some browsers that can't handle that level of security.
If you want to get like an A or an A-plus grade on SSL Labs, it requires things like perfect forward security and a few other things.
And we have that.
They don't work on early Android or like Windows 8.
So I could remove our security pattern, but then anybody could break it by just being a man in the middle and stepping down the handshake.
So what it sounds like we should do is put in, I forgot the exact name of the HTTP header that says, assume that you're going HTTPS even if the person types in HTTP. Yes. I forgot what the header is.
Yes.
And leave the HTTP in there, but only serving a static page that says...
Your browser is busted.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could do that. And actually serve a static page that has a link in it to HTTPS
the browsers
that says,
are busted,
sorry, your browser.
Yeah. The browsers that are busted are a fixed list. We can actually do a user agent.
All right, so that's your task this week. Okay. We can do that. I don't mind that.
That's the most pedantic thing. I think I've heard when people are talking about HTTPS migrations, most people just are like, Steam Engine's ahead. Security is
and it's,
in.
And it's not like it's going to hurt the world if you're not accessible. It doesn't matter. I think the RSS feed I should probably make also HTTP because what if old things can't read it? What do you think?
Even Firefox, it loads it. It just has the broken icon at the top.
No, I'm talking about like some RSS. I don't know. It doesn't matter. We'll switch to HTTPS and we'll lose, access for old computers. And if you want to talk to me about that, please feel free to email us. We still have email. We're geeks.
It's going
to
make life difficult for time travelers, isn't it?
Yes. geeks@geekspeak.org. Can you also get content that's been scraped by the Wayback Machine as HTTP?
HTTP.
Yeah.
The Wayback Machine is probably serviceable by HTTP or HTTPS. And therefore, if they've scraped your content, it's available.
Probably.
That's kind of
cool. As long as it's not hidden by JavaScript and AMPness.
They have a little bit of JavaScript, but they're a pretty good group.
God, now I really want to make a page that detects the older browsers and just goes like, you are actively in danger.
Why don't you make a little JavaScript code that does that?
Oh, gosh.
We'll call it map.
No, I would think user agent sniffing just a server side, just catch it and just go, pfft.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence's user by permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like, just let them know. Geek said hi. I want to thank Greg Merkley of our Canadian fame, who has been kind enough to give us today's working title of Recycled Rocket Tracks Amped Up Uber. Dee Dee and Miles, thank you so much for being on GeekSpeak with me today.
Always a pleasure.
Moose and Squirrel.
I also want to thank Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song. Thank you so much for listening to GeekSpeak, and we'll see you next week. This was episode 11 of season 17. And of course, if you want to look it up, it's the April 5th of 2017. Thanks so much. I'm Lyle Charks.
By the way, I did want to say something earlier on in the pre-show, but it was going to derail and get us. I thought it was funny that you were telling one of the Black Geeks, it sounds like there's too much bass in your voice. There's actually a long-running cultural joke there.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. What's the comment? I didn't say bass. I said boom. It's got a boom quality.
You also talk about bass, too. Yeah.
It's all about that bass, about that bass.
Yeah, I had this image of the original Bad Boys movie with Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. And he's like, hey, don't worry, we're the police. And he's like, no, man, you got too much bass in your voice. You got to talk like they do. You got to
more nasally?
Yes. We just came over to borrow a cup of sugar.
I didn't know that was a cultural thing. I'm such an ignorant.
Haven't you ever heard any Black comedians talk about how white people talk?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No. The white voice you just did was great. It's totally perfect. I just didn't associate it with basal tones. I didn't get
so
that.
So the way to refer to how Black folks talk in relation to white people is you got more bass in your voice.
Okay, I got that.
Myself not being a good example, but yeah.
I've always associated the bass in my voice with my monotone.
Your flat-like delivery?
It's, I have a varied monotone delivery. It's,
yeah.
It's loud or it's quiet.
I'm not very good at doing voices, you know, like my sister can like do voices really well. My daughter can do voices really well, but I don't have the ability to do that. So when I hear like you did white voice a second ago, I didn't get until you talked about bass and treble. It is higher and more nasally, but I wouldn't be able to know. I wouldn't be able to describe that without you saying it's more bass. Okay. I didn't know that.
Well, Charlotte, everything is a little bit more clear and enunciated. Things are
I don't know if it's little, really that enunciated.
They go
it's
through
just kind of
a different
you have
part
this
of your
lip at the end.
Oh, man. Too much bass in your voice. That's scared white folks. You got to sound like that. We were wondering if we can borrow some brown sugar.